This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I am Carolyn Bradner-Jasek. I happen to be the course director. I'm sorry. I wanted to apologize for not being here last week. I actually had an exam, and so I wasn't able to make it. And I am going to be talking today about how to talk to teens. And for those people that know me, some of whom are in the audience, they know I love to talk, so it's a good talk about talking. I wanted to do an introduction first to myself and then a little bit of an introduction to the course to give you a sense of how I had conceptualized this course kind of coming together. So I serve two roles at UCSF. I'm the assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics, and in that role do research and scholarship around risk-taking behavior in teens, specifically how to screen and intervene in primary care. But my other hat is I'm actually the assistant medical director for informatics for the Children's Hospital. So they actually are very synergistic because I get to play a lot with computers and play a lot with computers and teens. So that's a really fun part of my job, I think. In terms of the course, I just wanted to review our plan for the next 6 weeks, or I guess at this point five, and just go over the topics and kind of why we had sort of selected the ones that we did. The reason that I named the course The Kids Are All Right is it's the intent and goal of our faculty in delivering this course to relay and highlight that the teen years can be an exciting and amazing time. It's not a problem to be solved, it's a puzzle to discover. And those of us that work in the field love adolescence and feel like there's a lot to celebrate and a lot of positive parts about it. And we feel like often when talks like series like these are done, it tends to have a negative flavor. And so we pick topics that could be done from either standpoint. And our goal is to try to relay positivity and then also talk about when there's trouble, the best ways to intervene. So that was the spirit in picking the topic. So you'll hear from me this week. Next week, you'll hear from Marisa Raymond Flesch, who's a scholar in looking at underserved communities, specifically in California, a lot of rural health research, which I think is really interesting. Sarah Bucklew is the director of our eating disorder program, and she'll be part one of a two-part series on eating disorder management, which is a big part of our discipline. Daniel LaGrange is an internationally renowned scholar in eating disorder treatment and management, and he'll be talking about the latest research happening at UCSF around that. And then we'll finish with Laura Swong, who is also an internationally renowned scholar of looking at reproductive health issues in teens. So I think it's a nice array of topics. And last week we did mental health, which is near and dear to my heart. So let's get back to the topic of the day, which is how to talk to teens. So the goal of this talk really in general is to talk about or to highlight when you're speaking and interacting with teenagers, you need to be thinking about where that teen is in their developmental trajectory. And I like this quote to start with. It's an Aristotle quote. My sister happens to be a philosopher of science, so I get served up a lot of philosophy at family events. And she sent this my way one time because I was talking to her about studying risk behavior, and I think it really resonates with me that even way back then, he was commenting on how the young are heated by nature as drunken men by wine. In other words, their minds are literally clouded during the adolescent years. And you'll see throughout the talk tonight why I think that's so important, because teens don't act in a risky way just because they're risky and they don't care. They act that way because their brains are actively developing and remodeling during adolescence. And their ability to make judgments and do risk calculations are perhaps hindered by that normative developmental process. And so that's why I like this quote, and that's sort of the spirit of what we're going to talk about today. So I put up a couple quotes that I've heard from patients. With my clinical hat, I work in our adolescent and young adult clinic. So I get to see, today I had clinic, I got to see patients starting at age 12 all the way to 23. So I got to see the full trajectory of brain development in my clinic today. And these are quotes over the years that I've heard from parents when they come in struggling with their teen or young adult. They'll come in crisis and say something like, "What was she thinking? Did they not realize the consequences of what they were doing? Why didn't they just ask me first before they went ahead? And how can I get into that thick skull of his? And that's my particular favorite. Again, speaking about brain development, is how can I penetrate this seemingly impenetrable fortress that is my child's mind to try and get my point across? And the truth is, you can't get in because the brain is so busy remodeling that there literally isn't room for additional energy, I think, at times. So our main objectives and the order in which I will cover topics today is to start by describing trends in adolescent risk-taking behavior and the impact on health, to review typical adolescent development, highlight research on the developing brain, specifically research happening here at UCSF, and the important role of risk-taking in brain remodeling. And then finally, identify best practices on how to counsel and guide teens while still fostering resilience. So in addition to focusing on a developmental approach and understanding the brain development, the other thing that I really want to highlight today is the best way to promote resilience in teens is actually for them to go through this risk-taking process, that we learn way more from our mistakes, and our brain learns more from our mistakes than it does from our successes. So teens need to fail during their adolescence in order to develop the executive function and the sophisticated cognitive processes that they need for both young adulthood and later on adulthood by having these failures and navigating them. So when we think about risk-taking behavior, we think about kind of, I always call it like putting hamsters in a cage, that you still want them to run around the wheel, but you don't want them out of the cage because they'll get hurt or won't survive. And that's kind of what it is. So let's start with adolescent risk-taking behavior. I like this cartoon. How am I supposed to think about consequences before they happen? So that's the classic teen developmental challenge, is that they can't see the consequences right in front of them. I see some smirking, maybe perhaps from some parents that are going through this right now, where it seems like, did you think about what was going to happen when you decided to, go skateboarding down Fell Street in the middle of rush hour without a helmet? Were you kind of thinking about it? Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I thought it would probably be okay if I stayed on the sidewalk because the sidewalk's safer, but, the street would be unsafe. But I really thought if I did the sidewalk, that would be okay. And so really sort of that complex risk-benefit calculation. So what do we know about trends in adolescent behavior? Well, the good news is there's good news. And so really over the last 20 years, this is, again, where the kids are all right piece comes in. And you don't need to really think about the details, but just notice that almost all the lines are going down. So with the exception of obesity, and eating behavior, which I include as a risk-taking behavior, and we could talk about that and maybe have some fun arguing about it at the end of the talk, most risk-taking behavior is on the decline. I think if you watch the evening news or you read People magazine or heard the popular media, you would think that every teen is having sex willy-nilly without a condom and having babies left and right and smoking pot and doing all these things. But the truth is the data don't reflect that. This is all data collected nationally by various different entities through the YRBS at schools. And it essentially shows that things are improving overall. Just to highlight a couple of things, let's start with ever drank alcohol. So you can see that that's really on the steep decline. This line's a little bit light. That's did not use a condom during intercourse. So you can see 70% in 1991 when I was a teenager. That's why I was playing Salt and Pepper. And then in 2013, we're down to 40% having sex without a condom. Now, do they know the right thing to say on these surveys? Maybe so, but I take that as a really positive sign. So the truth is our teens are, to a certain extent, as time goes on, and maybe we're getting better as adults, kind of helping them navigate their process. They're kind of staying in their cage, but still kind of taking their chances. So what are the health consequences and other impacts of this behavior? So this is why we want to talk to teens and kind of keep them engaged during their adolescence, is we're worried about them. We're worried that there are going to be consequences that they don't see to their behavior. So the big one was, when I was a teenager, was pregnancy. So part of the reason that I got into adolescent medicine is that I had a childhood friend that got pregnant during high school, and she and I had a very different life trajectory. I had my children at 32. She had her first child at 17. And so that's a very, very different life path. And that was sort of the big topic when I was a teenager, both nationally and personally for me. But if you look at it over time, actually birth rates are declining in teens over the last decade. However, as that risk behavior declines, we see an increase in obesity. And of course, this is in the news. This is something that we hear about all the time. Obesity and eating behavior isn't like a typical risk-taking behavior in teens, but it is very similar in the sense that teens, especially early adolescents, live in the moment and don't really see the downstream effects of their behavior. So eating behavior is very much like that as well. And not eating healthfully and making bad choices about what you're eating is part and parcel of the same developmental process that's going in their brain that impacts other behaviors. More good news, juveniles in residential placement also declining. Dropout rates also declining, something that you wouldn't think is true, again, if you watch the news, but the data show that, in fact, and certainly there are pockets and groups and areas where these things are on the rise, but overall, kids are doing better. I like this one because it shows a little bit more of a stable trend, and it really gets down to the point of what our goal is for teens navigating the teen years. The reason we want to talk with them and engage with them is because we want them to have as full a life with as many opportunities as they can have. My goal is always the same goal as my patients and their parent, which is to have a future, to have options, to be self-sufficient, to be employed, to have a job that they enjoy, possibly go to college. All of those things are what we're all working toward. And so this statistic's just kind of interesting, which shows the percentage of youth who aren't enrolled in school nor working at any given time. And again, it's kind of high. It's about 8%, but it's not as high as you might think when, again, you watch the evening news. So what do we know about why adolescents engage in risk-taking behavior or sort of how the thinking happens? We'll talk about it from a brain standpoint, but I wanted to talk about it a little bit from a psychological standpoint. So several scholars here at UCSF in my department worked very, very hard in the sort of late 80s and early 90s to do a lot of research around risk-taking behavior in teens. They worked on trends, they worked on understanding teen risk-benefit calculations, and they really came up with these theoretical models that have really become the foundation of both my discipline and a lot of adolescent psychology, thinking about how risk-taking behavior can be conceptualized. So I really enjoyed this paradigm because I think it really highlights how these things come in together. So we start with this period of biological maturation, and that's combined with all these other factors that are going on in the teen's social milieu. Cognitive factors, self-perceptions, perceptions of their social environment, their personal values, and all of that gets fed in to this kind of risk calculation that teens go through, balancing the risks and the benefits. So let's think about our young man again, you know, tooling down Fell Street, or actually I should say Oak, shouldn't I? I've got my directions wrong. Tooling down Oak Street without a helmet on his skateboard, thinking, well, I'll just take the sidewalk, and that'll be safer because there aren't cars on the sidewalk, not thinking there could be pedestrians and other things. That's a risk perception, and that's based on his worldview and his risk-benefit calculation. And then you have the peer group and the peer influence that kind of comes into play. And then you have that risk-taking behavior and that decision-making that happens. What we've also learned is that there's covariation of risk behaviors. So kids exchange one risk behavior for another, and they travel together. And so as adolescents participate in risk behaviors, they tend to underestimate the risks, but also those engaging in any given risk behavior are more likely to be engaging in other risk behaviors. So they're correlated, and there may be an element of exchange. And this is important when you think back to our original graph about how risk-taking behavior overall is going down. What we've seen over the years is as one thing goes down, another thing kind of goes up. And again, that speaks to sort of the biological development. So here's an example from my world, which is eating behavior. So a big part of my research is looking at how to better screen and intervene in primary care around nutrition and physical activity in teens. And then after they're in clinic, thinking about ways to intervene and reach out to them and talk to them about their behavior. So what we discovered over time is that this concept of overnutrition and sedentary behavior is so complex. It involves biological factors, hormonal factors, things going on in the pituitary, the hypothalamus, the ovary. And then also we have, in addition to puberty, we have these other factors that are also happening. As all of these puberty-related factors are happening, some of those lead to overnutrition and sedentary behavior, but then we also have enormous social and environmental influences that are happening at the same time. And this is why we almost call it the perfect storm. You have this pubertal setup or brain setup or biological setup to be at risk for high-risk-taking behaviors, and then you add to that all of the other social and environmental factors that are going on. So how do teens think about engaging in risk behavior? So for perceptions of risk and vulnerability, again at UCSF, two scholars, Susan Milstein and Bonnie Halpern-Felscher, spent a long time talking to teens and doing interviews and asking them, when you're making these decisions, kind of what's going through your mind? Walk me through the process of how you decided to do this and do the other. And what they found, which was really interesting, is teens, no matter what age you asked, whether they were young or old, were always able to identify the consequences of their action. So who here grew up attending DARE? In their school. I did. It's a little bit dated, but maybe, or maybe not, I don't know. So I grew up going to DARE, and it was a big thing with Nancy Reagan, DARE for, you know, prevention, and Just Say No, and all of that. And those interventions were all based on knowledge. So who remembers sitting in a room and being told, your brain is going to fry, and those commercials where they would show your brain on drugs, and these sort of scare tactics. And it turns out, those don't work. They basically don't change behavior. So just seeing a fried egg in a pan is not going to make a teen behave differently. And so what we learned from that is teens are actually very, very skilled at identifying risk. And that people who are engaging in risk behavior acknowledge that these behaviors entail risk. That's what's so maddening about it. When you ask a teen, they'll say, yeah, I knew that a car could hit me on Oak Street. I thought about that. And you're like, well, if you thought about it, then why did you do it? Well, I just didn't think it was that likely. I mean, I knew that it could happen, but I don't know anyone that it happened to. I've never seen it happen. I figured if I was on the sidewalk, I'd be safer because there's no cars on the sidewalk. So they can talk through the fact that they know this consequence could happen, but they just don't see it as very likely. And this gets to the relationship between beliefs and behavior. So people who perceive less risk and felt less vulnerable to negative outcomes would be more likely to engage in those behaviors. And that's what Shauna and Bonnie found, is that the teens that calculated the risk as being much less were more likely to engage in the behavior. And the teens that had earlier development and more executive function and could map those consequences to how it would impact their future life were also less likely to engage in the behaviors. But kids that really couldn't balance, had sort of a tilted balance on how they were putting it together, were more likely to engage in the high-risk behaviors. And the perceived benefit, for example, of alcohol became a more important predictor than risks in their intent to drink alcohol, as an example. So the benefit, friends, having fun, being included, being invited to the party, being able to relax, all of these benefits far outweigh the possible consequence of ER visit, drunk driving, somebody being hurt. It's just in their mind, they could state what the consequence is. It's just how they balance it is a little bit different. So what are the protective factors? So when we're talking to teens or we're interviewing a teen or screening a teen, what are the protective factors and what suggests to us that the teen may be at lower risk? So this, again, gets to a similar model where we're talking about the combination of biology and genetics, social environment, allostatic load. So there's a slight difference between social environment and allostatic load. Social environment is your true social environment, your socioeconomic status, where you live, your community. Allostatic load is a concept developed here at UCSF and now adopted in a widespread way, talking about people's relative sense of their social status. So you can have a kid who's sort of in the lowest income in a high income area, and they feel impoverished because their relative standing to their peer group is less than the other ones around them. And that contributes to some risk-taking behavior or some perception of social risk. Then you have just their sort of personality and then the risk behavior that they're engaging in. And it's a balance between risk factors and protective factors for each of these. So to use an example, for allostatic load, a protective factor could be a child who lives in a relatively low-income area but tends to be at the higher income level and has more opportunity and more access to certain things than his peers may feel more protective factors around risk behavior and see more future in kind of their life, whereas a biological risk factor might be early puberty. So we know that kids that develop earlier are at higher risk for engaging in risk behaviors because they get assigned in their peer group a higher developmental status than their mind is actually at. So that would be an example. And then, of course, this leads to two kinds of behavior, either high risk or health promoting. Obviously, we want the health promoting behavior, but as I mentioned, the risk behavior is really important too. And then that leads to health outcomes. And the health outcomes are the things that we're either trying to avoid or things that are positive. I'm unfortunately, I don't think this came out very well, but I like this slide because this speaks to, I think, a problem that we have right now with parenting, actually, in America in particular, around wanting to protect kids from all risk. So this is the percentage of children whose parents report usually or always exhibiting selected characteristics of flourishing. And this is a resilience measure. So when I use the word resilience, I think of literally a kid that can bounce back from adversity. And I had a psychologist tell me one time, adversity will come and adversity is important. And kids learn from adversity and that's how they develop grit. And if kids aren't resilient, if they're protected too much from every possible problem, they're not going to develop both the executive function to navigate issues and the coping function, the coping mechanisms to get through it. And so if you look at this graph, you see that the lower percentage of where kids were scoring on this survey were children staying calm and in control when faced with a challenge. So I have a clinic full of kids that get all A's but are suicidal, depressed, can't navigate the Muni on their own, need to call their mom the first week of college in order to help them navigate their schedule, and yet they can get all A's on all of their tests. And the reason is because they haven't developed these protective factors, this resilience that they need to survive. And this is, of course, helicopter parenting. And this can stifle and prevent key steps in the cognitive, social, and emotional development. So this is just setting us up for when you're thinking about talking with teens and you're interacting with teens, the goal is not to prevent risk. And it's not a zero-sum game where you're saying, I'm going to help you avoid any possible problem so that you can get all A's and go to Harvard. Because the problem is they're going to go to Harvard, get really drunk the first weekend, and end up in the ER because they have no coping mechanisms to survive regular life. And so this is an important piece of this, of us setting up talking to teens. So these are some books I really like. For those of you that have kids, and these slides will be on the web so you can get them later, these are books that I recommend to my patients all the time. For those of you that haven't been to a talk by Madeline Levine, she's, or Levine, I don't know how she says it. She's local, she lives in Marin, and she does talks pretty often around the Bay Area. I would encourage you, if you have the opportunity to go, because I think her perspective is really great on teens and building resilience. And then Ken Ginsberg, people joke, is the Oprah of adolescent medicine, because he's this amazing physician, truly old soul, who really whole goal in life is talking about resilience and about flipping the negative around adolescent medicine and stop talking about risk behavior and start talking about how can we promote positive youth development in our kids and talk to them in a way that will make them feel confident and have grit. So I like this phrase, failure is not an option. It actually may be essential for building resilience, grit, and other life skills. So this is, again, to just punctuate what we've been talking about for the last few minutes, that failure isn't an option. It's not optional. It's required for adolescents, and they need to fail in order to succeed. So here's an example. So this was a National Geographic article that I thought was interesting because it was written by a parent, and I think this happens a lot with journalists, is that they get to a certain point in their career and then their kids become teenagers and they start to write articles about the teen years. And this was one of those. And it's a story about one fine May morning not long ago, my oldest son, 17 at the time, phoned to tell me that he had just spent a couple hours at the state police barracks for driving a little fast. And it turns out he was going 115, and the parent says, that's more than a little fast. And he agreed, and he sounded somber and contrite, and he didn't object when I told him he'd have to pay the fines. And he didn't argue when I pointed out that anything can happen at that speed. He even offered that the cop did the right thing in stopping him. He said, we can't all go around driving 113. But he did object to one thing. He didn't like it that one of the several citations he received was for reckless driving. Well, getting ready to get all upset, he said, what would you call it? I mean, it's obviously reckless. And the teen said, well, it's just not accurate. Reckless sounds like you're not paying attention, but I was. In fact, I made a deliberate point of doing this on an empty stretch of road, dry interstate, in broad daylight, with good sight lines and no traffic. I mean, I wasn't just gunning the thing. I was driving. I guess that's what I want you to know, if it makes you feel better. I really was focused. And so I think this is classic teen thinking, is, yeah, I was going 115. I know I can die from that. But I really thought about it, Dad. I really thought about how I could make it as safe as possible to drive 115 on the interstate. And this is classic teen thinking. And this is normal. I mean, it's scary and it could have ended poorly, but this is a normal part of testing during adolescence and trying these theories and trying these things out. And it's scary because there can be really, really bad consequences. So is this scenario normative or concerning? I would assert that it's normative. And our conclusions from this first part are that teens understand the consequences and risks of their behavior, but they also perceive benefits to their behavior that may outweigh the risks in their mind. Perhaps engaging in risky behavior is a normal and essential step in adolescent development. So now we're going to talk a little bit about typical adolescent development. I hate this cartoon. Who has seen this before? Anybody? No? I hate it. It reminds me of this. I just went through the horrific private school application process in San Francisco, and I was in this room full of parents who all like were trying to impress the head of school. And the head of school got up and immediately made some disparaging joke about teenagers and about how here you are all for the kindergarten applications, but before you know it, you'll be in my office talking about your, you know, teen, and we'll all be navigating that together. Ha ha. And the whole room laughs and everybody talks about, isn't it great that that's 12 years away? And I think it again gets to the point of this negativity about the teen years and this negativity. And I think that when we talk to teens, they feel that negativity. They hear those jokes. They hear everybody saying, oh, next year she'll be a teenager. Watch out. You know, lock up your liquor. And all these jokes that happen around the family and people talk about, the teens feel that. And they feel that negativity. And they don't feel like they're entering this exciting, amazing time in their life. They feel like it's some burden that they're like inflicting on their family. And I think that when we talk to teens, we need to remember that. We need to talk about how amazing it is to be an adolescent and how many of us would love to go back to high school and make a few different choices and maybe make our life go in a slightly different path or have that amazing concept that there are no consequences. I would love to live a life without consequences, frankly. My life is full of consequences. And so the negativity. So I think of it as tasks, that there are these very essential pieces that need to be accomplished during the teen years. And we need to get through those, and they're important, and they need to happen on time, and they need to happen in a way that sets us up for success in later life. So, of course, there's the physical development. That's really kind of beyond our control. And that's the physical maturation, pubic body hair, all of these different things. And I think we all know that that kind of happens on autopilot. But then there's the social and emotional piece. I remember the first day I started adolescent fellowship, my attending physician, which means sort of the boss, said to me, if you go into a room and a teen says that they talk to their parent all the time about what they're doing and that they really love connecting with them and that their parent is their best friend, you've got a problem. Because a normal teen will be grumpy, will say, she doesn't have any idea what's going on in my life. She's intrusive, bossy, and always wants to know what I'm doing. That is what you're expecting, and that should be what you're seeing. So emotional separation from parents, a very, very key part of adolescence. Greater sense of personal identity, identification with a peer group, exploration of romantic relationships. I think we all know about that. Positive sexual health is a huge part of the teen years. Again, the immense negativity put on women during adolescence about their reproductive health. You're going to get pregnant and it's going to ruin your life. And then you take that into your 30s and you still think it's going to ruin your life when you have a kid. And you can't shake this sort of idea that it's horrible what's happening to your body and that this baby is going to ruin your career and ruin your opportunity. And it's all so just so very negative. Whereas sex can be this amazing and positive thing that two people can share together. And so just flipping it on the other side and talking to your teens in a way that's positive. Because if you don't, they'll just go underground and they won't share with you what's happening because you've already made it this negative thing. So cognitive development, and we'll go into this in detail in a few minutes. Increased capacity for abstraction and advanced reasoning, greater impulse control, more effective assessment of risk versus reward, improved use and manipulation of working memory, improved language skills, and increased capacity to self-regulate emotional states. Of course we want all these things. These are the things that we want for our kids, but they're not going to get them if they don't have some failures and if they don't go through some difficult times and develop those coping skills in order to develop those higher executive functions. And then the sort of moral development, the greater ability to take others' perspectives. I don't know how many of you have a teenager or have had a teenager, but how many times have you wished, doesn't she see it from my side? Doesn't she understand how this is impacting me? I feel that way sometimes, honestly, with my six-year-old. And the greater ability to sort of understand how what you're doing impacts others. They don't have the ability to do that early in adolescence. They can't see the other person's side. It really, truly, in their mind, is hardwired to be all about them. It's not that they're selfish. That's what's happening in their brain. May question the values of parents and institutions. And that's great. You know, I thought that I was going to... I don't know what I thought in college. I thought I was going to solve teen pregnancy, basically. Went off to Washington, was convinced that I was going to do that. What an amazing sense of optimism and ego to think that you're going to accomplish something like that. I would love to live my life believing firmly that, you know, I can get an apartment in Arlington, Virginia and solve teen pregnancy. Like, I would love to do that. Now I just can't get my six-year-old to go to bed on time. But that sort of perception of questioning your parents and institutions, again, normative. So how does adolescence progress? So a lot of people talk about specific ages. So in our field, we talk about developmental age, not chronological age. So I think we all have met an 18-year-old that's kind of more like a 14-year-old, right? Or a 14-year-old that's kind of more like an 18-year-old. And I think we all feel it in our gut. And when we're interacting with them, we can kind of tell and we know and we can recognize it. But I would encourage you to think about it. Wow, this teenager is kind of more of an early adolescent, and they're kind of putting things together in kind of a concrete way, and I'm going to talk about that in a second, what concrete means and what that cognitive development is. Whereas a middle adolescent, I call the developmental dead zone. They're kind of in the middle of this time where they're not a young kid and they're not an old kid, and they kind of walk around in this fog of like, should I follow my peers? Should I do my own thing? And it's all very confusing and doesn't seem to be very purposeful. And that's sort of the middle adolescence. And then late adolescence, getting ready to leave the home, thinking about the next step, wondering about how what they're doing now is going to affect their future, all the things that you've been hoping that they could have known when they were 12 and were hopefully not, but perhaps making decisions that would impact those later phases. And that's what people worry about as parents. So a couple things about physical development that I just wanted to highlight. Puberty is a topic really for another day, but I did want to talk about how the onset of puberty is earlier in girls than boys. And this is important because girls develop more advanced executive functioning a little earlier than boys. And so I think we all knew that in middle school, that, you know, we had it a little bit more together than the guys did. And it's because our brains were farther along in our development, and that was our biology. And early development leads to more risk-taking behavior and bullying, by the way. So kids that develop a little bit earlier are much more likely to be bullied because they're a developmental mismatch with the other kids. They're thinking about things differently. They're interacting with people differently. They look different. They have, you know, women-sized breasts, they have, their period earlier, and all these different things that are happening. And so bullying, very high risk for bullying. And late bloomers are also at risk for bullying. So kids that develop a little later than the other kids are also at risk for bullying. Because again, it's not just how they look, which is what I think we always assume. It's that they're literally kind of acting still like a little kid because their brain just hasn't really taken that next step. And so other kids see that and they get bullied for it. So the cognitive developmental tasks that we want to see during adolescence are more advanced reasoning skills, thinking hypothetically. We call those contrary fact situations. Well, if I did this, what would happen next? Using a logical thought process, the ability to abstract, moving from concrete thinking. So concrete thinking is what we call black and white thinking, where I'll tell a teen, you should wear a condom because you're going to get pregnant. Well, I've had sex 2 times and I didn't get pregnant. Well, you know, you're still at risk. But my friends have never gotten pregnant. Do they use condoms? No. How many times has your friend had sex? 3. And so this sort of black and white thinking of I have some information in my mind that leads me to a conclusion that's very yes, no. And there's no sort of gray. And another classic parent example would be, well, you told me that we were going to go to the store after school. Well, things changed. You know, I don't know, something happened and we're not going to go. But you promised. Like, are you 3 or are you 13? I told you already, we don't have time to go today. But you promised. And so it's this concrete thinking of black and white. You, and then also assigning that to individuals. You're good, you're bad, you're somewhere in the middle. I love you, I hate you, get out of my life. Like, it's this sort of concrete thinking. And as they get older and they have more complex thinking, it facilitates complex social relationships. So obviously, if you're not thinking in black and white, you can have a more complex and fruitful relationship with someone. So dating for a 12-year-old is very different relationship than dating for an 18-year-old. I'll have a teen come in and say, I have a boyfriend. And I'll say, oh, when did you meet your boyfriend? Yesterday. And he's already your boyfriend? Yes. That would be a 13-year-old answer. An 18-year-old would say, well, I've been with this guy for 3 months, but I'm just not sure yet whether I would call him my boyfriend. I'm not sure he meets all my criteria for what a boyfriend would be. And that's a much more complex understanding of what a social relationship would be. And then operational thinking, enabling adolescents to think about what they're feeling and how others perceive them. And we kind of already talked about that. So how does this relate to counseling? And some of this is review, but I have some things down here in terms of how do you approach talking to a teen at these sort of different phases of development. So for that concrete thinker, you need simple messages. So you can't tell them, you're going to smoke marijuana, it's going to screw up your life. They're just not going to get that. But you can say, you shouldn't smoke marijuana because you have a test on Monday and you're not going to be able to participate in that test. Okay. You shouldn't smoke marijuana because your friend Susie doesn't smoke marijuana and she may not want to be your friend. You know, talking about peer relationships. And then engaging parents. I can't tell you how many parents I have that it's hard, right? You raise kids until 12, and now they're a teenager, and you're thinking, I'm going to go out to eat. I'm going to be able to live my life. We can finally travel. We don't need an expensive nanny anymore. We can do all these things that we haven't done. It's actually a time when you need to dig in and get more involved. So remember the hamster in the cage. You need to build that cage around your teen, especially in the early adolescence. How do you build that cage? Get involved in the peer group that they're developing. Don't let them quit their sport. Keep them involved in things. Make sure that they're navigating in the right social environment so that their peer group is health promoting. I call that supervised independence because they're living in the now. They can't see what the consequences are for the choices that they're making at this age. Middle adolescence. So this is a time when they're really overly optimistic versus realistic about their future health. So this is the classic 16-year-old that comes into my office and I say, well, would you like birth control because you're sexually active? No. Well, why not? Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of plus minus about getting pregnant. And I'll say, well, what would be the good sides of being pregnant? Well, I'd have something, you know, that I could love, and I'm really good with babies, and my partner really wants a baby. What would be the downside? Well, I guess I'd miss school, you know, and sort of thinking it through that way, this sort of overly optimistic about their future. So in that group, you really need to leverage the peers. What do your friends say about it? Do you have a friend that's gotten pregnant? Have you spent any time with someone who's been pregnant? Do you understand kind of what's involved? Late adolescence, they can really understand future consequences. So those are the patients that I start to talk to about, well, let's walk through what you want to do after high school. How would having a baby affect after high school? 16-year-old likely can't have that conversation. But a 17 or 18-year-old, well, let's say 14-year-old more, can't have that conversation. But a 17 or 18-year-old really can have that conversation. Let's talk about the marijuana. You're doing college applications right now. What would happen if you got caught with weed at school? Oh, I'd get in big trouble. Well, not only would you get big trouble, but it would go on your record, which goes to colleges. Really? Yes, it does. And they're like, whoa, okay, no more marijuana. What if you got caught in the car with marijuana? I bring up marijuana because it's so pervasive in San Francisco. Well, I don't really know. I mean, if I'm not driving, it's not a big deal. Actually, it's a really big deal. It's drug possession. You'd get arrested, and that would go on your record for college applications. Really? Yes. So you can talk about those future consequences. So then let's talk about social things. So you can also leverage where they are in their social status. So an early adolescent wants to be normal. So you need to help them define a new normal. If they're in an environment where they're not doing things that are health promoting, you want to shift them to an environment that's more health promoting. Still connected to parents, work that connection, and you can also work the peer angle. During middle adolescence, it's a challenging combination of peer influence and rejection of parents. So this is a time where they say, my mom has no idea what's going on in my life. I can't stand her. Whereas an early adolescent might say, I see my mom's point, and I know she'll get mad at me, but da-da-da. But the middle adolescent is sort of saying, I disregard what my dad says. He has no idea what's going on in my life. So that's when sometimes I'll actually bring in the boyfriend. And I'll say, well, bring your boyfriend on in here. Let's talk about getting pregnant and what that would look like. Let's have a conversation together. Bring in your best friend. And we'll all talk together about what it would mean to have sex without a condom. Late adolescence. You can also leverage individual relationships because this is the time when they really start making those complex social relationships. So talk to your partner about your decisions. Talk to your friends about what they're doing. And the other problem with late adolescence is it's actually a high-risk time for depression because kids that are not engaging in health-promoting activities and haven't developed resilience and don't start to see other kids pass them by are at really high risk for depression. So you have to kind of keep an eye on that. So now the fun part, we get to talk about the teen brain in more detail. So this is another fun cartoon. Young man, go to your room and stay there until your cerebral cortex matures. I like this cartoon. So this is Piaget. who of course came up with all the cognitive development. Now, he didn't have functional MRI in that time, but he came up with this sort of stage four formal operations phase of cognitive development during the teen years, which again is review, but as we go to this part about brain development, it's good to review the ability again to think about abstract or hypothetical concepts, considering issues from someone else's perspective, and solving cognitive problems in a logical way. Again, these are the jobs of adolescence, and these are the things that we need to accomplish. So brain development starts in early adolescence, and the brain goes through a rapid cycle of remodeling. So there's this high uptake of brain development that happens when kids are younger, and then it kind of gets remodeled and re-engineered when adolescence starts. And because of that, it's an extremely vulnerable time to traumatic injuries, psychological trauma, and addiction. So kids that have psychological trauma during their teen years, it stunts their cognitive development, sometimes permanently, because they're not able to psychologically go through the required phases of development because they're stunted by the trauma that they've experienced. Things like sexual assault, domestic violence, intimate partner violence, all of those different kinds of traumas that they could experience. And then addiction is another one. We're only starting to learn the effects of nicotine on the developing brain and what that means for the patient's, for the teen, I'm always thinking about patients, reward center development and kind of how they, for the rest of their life, really think about risk and reward can be permanently altered by chemical injury. And we're also learning that the brain develops and matures well into the mid-20s. So if there's anything that you remember about this talk, it would be that point, that this process of remodeling and brain development actually extends into the 20s. So who's read sort of the news? It was kind of about 5 years ago that came out about the National Institutes of Health brain study where they did functional MRIs and looked at brain development of teens over time. And that's what the major conclusion was, is we all thought it was at 18 they leave the house, but it's actually well into the mid-20s that the brain is still developing and still finalizing these advanced cognitive functioning. So the prefrontal cortex, I've been talking a lot about executive function. This is the window into risk-taking behavior, and this fosters a lack of vulnerability once it's fully developed. And it's located in the front, the prefrontal cortex, and the brain development and remodeling that happens during the adolescent and young adult years starts in the back and goes into the front. And the limbic system is the next part that starts developing. This is where the amygdala is, and this is your emotional center. This is where you have control over impulsivity, where you might be moody or emotional. So as the brain is developing and remodeling, you're going to see the emergence of moodiness, emotional dysregulation, lack of ability to think things through logically, and it's all because the brain is going through a natural process. And this was done, I actually don't know how to properly pronounce his name, which I wouldn't normally worry about, but since I'm going to be on YouTube, I guess, I think it's Geed, but we'll see. At the National Institute of Mental Health, made a movie basically of normal brain changes from age 5 to 20. He used functional MRI to measure the brain function and found that the gray matter thickens in childhood but then thins, and it completes sooner in girls than boys. So again, this is the biological evidence of what Piaget always knew and what we know as sort of parents and clinicians, is that this is a biologically different process that's normative, that's expected, and extends into the 20s. And it was cool for my field to have this because we all felt very legitimized. We had this sort of seminal meeting a few years ago where the gentleman from NIMH came to our national meeting, and we're all like, yes, it's not just because we're, you know, fun people that like teens. This is biology. And so it was very, very empowering for all of us to have the scientific proof of what we've always said, which is that this is a normative, biologically driven process, and we're just beginning to understand it. So what is functional MRI? So this is neuroimaging that measures brain activity by detecting associated changes in blood flow. It assumes cerebral blood flow and neuronal activation are linked. So in other words, it measures where blood is going in the brain, and we assume that where the blood goes, that's where the activity centers and where things are happening. And when an area of the brain is in use, blood flow to that region also increases. And this is what was used to map the adolescent brain. So this is sort of the big image of his study showing essentially this development by age of the brain activity and the remodeling activity. And they call this synaptic pruning. The gray matter is due to this synaptic pruning, which eliminates unnecessary nerve cell connections And the more environmental input there is to guide that pruning, the better. So we think that the more stimulation the teen and young adult gets from their environment, the more complex and mature the pruning is. So if you stunt them with a trauma or stunt them with helicopter parenting, the pruning won't happen as it's supposed to. That's what we think. But again, we're just starting to figure this out. So a scholar, again, in my department, Mark Rubenstein, has been looking at this related to smoking. And his evaluation of adolescent smokers showed a decreased brain response to pleasurable food images compared with non-smokers. And he thinks that this is due to nicotine. So nicotine could potentially permanently alter both the pruning process and then also the process by which sort of the pleasure center is activated in the amygdala and into the prefrontal cortex. And that would be a shame because that would probably stick with kids forever. Not to make too much out of preliminary work, but this is kind of what the energy right now is about the adolescent brain in research. In other words, the benefits at a neuronal level outweigh the risks. So what we've always thought is that at the neuronal level, the kids in their brain are preferentially weighing higher the pleasurable aspects of life, exactly what we were saying at the beginning. I really like riding my skateboard. It's really fun. Going down Oak Street is like really fun. My friend's going to be with me. We're going to have this awesome time. We're going to feel so good about the fact that we did this. My other friend's going to think we're so awesome because he's a wimp and doesn't want to do it. All of these, it's activating some pleasure center in the brain that's overshadowing the risk calculation, and that's normal. So the adolescent brain undergoes rapid and prolonged development from age 12 to 25, and this process likely depends on key environmental inputs for expected change. And the key areas of cognitive and emotional functioning may be vulnerable during this time to insult. So I know I'm repeating myself, but I think it's helpful to sort of revisit the concepts as we go through them, because some of this can be a little bit complex and in detail. So now, in the last 7 minutes, I guess, how do we talk to teens? So how do I talk to teens? How should you talk to teens? Maybe you're wondering how you should talk to your granddaughter or your grandson. How should you talk to your friend? This seems like a pretty mixed group. So this is a cartoon that I like that says, "My parents never talk to me about sex. All they talk about is SAT. And so true. So I have parents that they like tackle me in the hallway and they're like, "I need to talk to you before the visit." I'm like, "About what?" "I think he's having sex. I need you to talk to him about that." Like, "Did you talk to him about that?" "No." "Well, why haven't you talked to him about it?" "Oh, he won't listen to me." And I'll say, "Well, he's not going to listen to me because I've only got 15 minutes according to Aetna, and I'm not sure I'm going to get that much in, but I'll give it a good try." And so I spend usually my 15 minutes trying to get the parent and the teen on the same page. But it's all of this. I've had notes passed to me. I've had emails sent to me. "I think he's smoking weed." "Well, why do you think he's smoking weed?" "Because I found one in his backpack." "Well, did you talk to him about it?" "No." "He'll get mad at me." "Well, would that be a bad thing if he got mad at you?" And so it's just this hesitance for some reason to either, and Madeline Levine talks about this, to cause displeasure, to contaminate the relationship. I really don't know what it's about, but they really love our clinic because they think that we're going to, you know, talk to them and solve this. And then we have other parents that say, "We've already talked about it, and here we are for our birth control." And we get both in our clinic. So how do we intervene in our clinic? So we've done a ton of research. As we were waiting for the fMRI, we spent a lot of time in our field doing interventions and trying to change adolescent risk-taking behavior. And I'm really proud to actually be part of the division here at UCSF because a lot of the seminal work on behavior change interventions was done here at UCSF with a lot of different investigators. Elizabeth Ozer is one looking at how to change risk behavior in clinics. Botvin's actually in New York. Life skills training is a primary prevention. Family-based treatment for obesity. Epstein, sexual health outcomes with clinic-based interventions to prevent pregnancy risk. And so these are all different interventions trying to figure out how can we talk to teens to get them to sort of stay in their cage, have some fun, not too much, and emerge with a prefrontal cortex that's totally intact. And again, we learn that the knowledge is not power. You need to apply what you learned, and that's really the thing. So all of these interventions have what we call more of a skills-based behavioral approach. So we start with some information, but really the bulk of the intervention and the bulk of the conversation is spent talking about the behavior itself, not the consequences, but more about the risk calculation, about kind of their social environment, and trying to figure out a way to get them to do things differently. So here's an example from my own world, which is obesity prevention and intervention. And what I am constantly telling people, because the obesity world, unfortunately, has gone full circle and ignored, in my opinion, 20 years of behavioral research showing that knowledge is not power. So I can't tell you how many pediatricians across the country are trying to tackle obesity by handing out handouts on nutrition. So I bet you could ask any teen in America, what is a nutritious dinner? And they would be able to tell you. So giving someone a handout about adequate nutrition is not going to get them to change their behavior. And so my field, unfortunately, has taken a huge step back. So this is a recent guideline that I put together for pediatricians to talk about how I approach obesity intervention and treatment. It gives you an example of how I talk to teens. So I start by assessing the behavior, and we'll go to the next page in a second about what that assessment looks like. I also do a mental health assessment. If somebody's in the middle of anxiety and depression, any messages that you're trying to relay, anything you're trying to say to somebody is going to be impaired by where they are in terms of their mental health status. I do a psychosocial assessment. Remember back to that figure where I showed all those different factors that impact behavior. So real time, when I'm really interacting with a teen, I'll ask about how's problems, school issues, substance abuse, child abuse. I'll get the data on the BMI and target my counseling to that. And then, of course, I do my regular medical evaluation. But what the vast majority of pediatricians do is they ask some nutrition questions, what kinds of stuff do you eat, and then they give them a handout. And we've learned for decades that that's not going to make a difference. Now, obviously, this is time-consuming, and that's why people don't do it. And that's where my other hat from informatics comes, because we can leverage computers to do a lot of those screening and a lot of that counseling. So this is my behavior assessment. People spend a lot of time thinking about the what. So you don't even see that there, the what of what they're eating. I do just the who, where, when, why, and how. I know the what is bad because that's why I'm talking to them in the first place. So I don't need to count how many donuts they ate for breakfast in the last week. I know that's happening. So instead, I spend a lot of time talking about who are they eating with? Where are they eating? When are they eating? Are they eating regular meals? Are they skipping breakfast? Why? Are they eating intuitively? Are they overeating when they're stressed? And how do they eat? Do they feel guilty after eating? Are they lying about what they're eating? It's all this behavior piece of it, and then it's the skills that go with it. Let's walk through a meal. You have these routines. A lot of my kids stop on the way home from school at the corner store and buy like a bag of Cheetos and some chips. Well, let's talk about how that could look different. You're leaving school. Instead of your routine of going to the corner market and buying your Cheetos, what other things that could you do to avoid that behavior? The classic attempt would be to say, well, let's talk about the corner store. Do they sell bananas? Could you buy a banana? Not understanding that, no, they're not going to buy a banana because once they're at the corner store, they're going to do the routine. They're going to buy the Cheetos and the soda because that's what their friend is buying. So instead, you want to talk to them about, could you hang out with a different friend? Could you do something else? Could you guys do a sport this year so you're not walking by the corner store? Could you not bring money to school? So all these different kinds of approaches. So the key components of successful programs are ones that establish a knowledge base for sure, but promote resilience, understand the socio-ecological factors, think about being long-term connections with kids, and focus on skills-based learning. You want to capitalize on peer involvement and empower parents to reinforce the messages. So getting parents involved is so key. And that's the next part. Who should be talking to teens? Medical providers. So back in, gosh, I think I ended up publishing this in 2000, but I'll be quite honest with you, I did it in 1997, but I was too busy taking the MCAT to write up the paper. But in 2000, I did this study that where we looked at where do young adults get health information from, looking at a national survey, and we found that only 22% of them said their doctor. And everyone else said, well, the TV or, you know, my friends and going to a lecture, reading a brochure. So again, I have very little impact on teens. It's the parents. Parents are the most powerful. And when you ask teens, when it comes to your teens' decisions about sex, who's the most influential? Teens say, 38% say their parent is the most influential person in their life about the decisions that they're making. And these are the same parents that are like, could you talk to him about the weed? And I'm like, you need to talk to him because you live with him and you can impose the consequences. How much do you agree or disagree with the following statement? It would be much easier for teens to postpone sexual activity and avoid pregnancy if they were able to have more open, honest conversations about these topics. 80% of teens agree. How much do you agree with this? Parents believe they should talk to their kids about sex, but often don't know what to say. 90% agree. So hopefully part of coming today is you've gotten a little bit more empowered to think about how can I open that window with my kid. And so we're going to talk about that, and that's the last thing. We're going to do 10 sort of easy tips about talking to a teen. And the first thing I wanted to talk about was parenting styles. So we always go for the authoritative parent. Has anyone seen this graph before? This is one of my favorite things in pediatrics. It talks about all the different kinds of parenting styles. And, you know, I've been all of these actually for my kids. We all kind of go different ways and approach things in different ways. The permissive parent is the one that's highly supportive but makes few rules and trusts rather than monitors. I trust you'll do the right thing. The one who wants to be their friend. The uninvolved parent sets few rules but doesn't really monitor. Kids will be kids. You'll learn from your mistakes. That's the uninvolved, not present parent. The authoritarian parent. This would be potentially my Midwestern upbringing, which was set many rules and closely monitor and wash their mouth out with dial soap on occasion. And you'll do as I say, and that's what's what. And that works. Kids comply, but they don't develop the ability to make good decisions on their own and are much more likely to engage in secretive high-risk behavior. And then, of course, the authoritative parent, who's highly supportive and closely monitors and sets rules. Again, building that nice cage where the gerbils can run around, the hamsters can run around, but they're there watching. I care, and I'll give you the freedoms you earn, but for safety-related issues, you'll do as I say. So number one, be authentic. So I will forever be who I am. A not very cool woman from the Midwest, raised pretty conservatively, kind of privileged. I'm never going to be cool. I'm never going to have the right language to interact with a teen at their level. And it turns out they don't care. I've provided care on the south side of Chicago, Trenton, New Jersey, inner city Oakland, inner city San Francisco, privileged kids in San Francisco, privileged kids in Chicago. And the key is just being real. They have a very, very, very good BS detector. And they know when you're not being true. So don't try to be cool. Just stay cool and calm. Don't try to be cool and get on their level. They don't want that. They don't want their doctor or their mom or their grandmother or their older mentor to be cool. They want them to be real. Lean in. I've already discussed this. Make rules, stay positive, and your kids need their parents more during these years than they ever have before. Look for an opening. When opportunity knocks, open the door and let them know you're available. This could happen at the worst time. You could be in the car on the way to an important meeting and you could hear from the side, Mom, did you ever get an IUD? And you have to sort of say, that's an interesting question. Why do you ask? I don't know. I was just curious. No, I never got an IUD, but I did birth control. What do you know about IUDs? This could be a huge opening to an enormous amount of information, so you have to be open to those little moments. Listen first and talk later. This is so hard for me in particular, is shut up and just listen and don't give advice. It's very hard for me. I'm a pediatrician. I want to solve problems. I want to talk. And I have to literally like sometimes be like this and just let the teen talk because they want to have a conversation. They don't want to get a lecture. And you have to understand how they're putting the risk-benefit together in order to do the intervention. So actually what you want is to change their behavior and connect with them. So you actually need to understand what's going on in their brain, and you're not going to get there if you're lecturing. And you have to respect their opinion, even if it's totally off base. So even if the kid's like, well, you know, I don't know, I thought I'd be okay because I was on the sidewalk. Well, that's interesting. I kind of see it a little differently. And instead of saying, are you an idiot? Like, you could have gotten hit by a car. You have to respect their opinion. Be specific and keep it simple. Remember that teens can be concrete. No complex explanations, no complex things. You just have to keep it really simple. And be nosy but not intrusive. Don't go through their room, but ask them questions. Respect their privacy. Trust that they'll make the right choice. Trust that you've done a good job. But know their friends. You can tell a lot about your own child by their friends. And we have our own BS detector, right? So if you meet the friend and you're like, this kid's kind of not on track, then that might be an alarm bell for your kid. Lead by example. Teens are always keeping score. My children are always keeping score. Mommy, how come you get to have ice cream tonight? How come you get to drink mommy juice, which is wine, by the way, and I don't get to drink juice? So starting even at 6, they're calculating fairness, right? And so you have to lead by example. So do what you say and say what you do. And that's hard. It's hard when you've been in the trenches for 12 years with a kid to keep your behavior on track. I mean, I'm having hard enough time at 6. And so, but you really do need to do that because they're watching you. They're getting way more from watching you than what you tell them about what they should be doing. Be realistic. So some risk taking is normative, as we've discussed. If we overprotect, they miss out on key developmental tasks. So choose your battles. It can't be everything. You know, you have to, I would say, go with safety over all else, but don't sweat the little stuff because it's just, you're not going to get anywhere. Be consistent. Get on the same page with your partner. So if you're co-parenting with someone else, make sure that you guys have consistent messages and get all the parents on the same page. Because if kids get sort of differing opinions and messages, it can be confusing. But most importantly, know the warning signs. So you always want to look out for when things are getting into the danger zone. Extreme weight gain or loss, sleep problems, rapid or drastic changes in personality, sudden change in friends, skipping school, falling grades, talking or joking about suicide, signs of drug use, and run-ins with the law. These are all warning signs that you're now past the point of kind of allowing the risk-taking to happen. These are the times when you need to intervene. And these are the times that I would love to help you. Bring your child in to see their pediatrician and say, I see things that are really concerning. But don't say, will you talk to him about it? Come in and say, I need some help for us as a family to work on this together. These are some handouts that you guys can look at. Just reviewing our objectives. We're at the end now. Current trends in adolescent risk-taking behavior. We've reviewed that. The typical adolescent development. We've highlighted research on the developing brain, and we've identified best practices on how to counsel and guide teens. And I think the key take-home points for today are that adolescent development is hardwired, but it's also malleable. Knowledge is not power. Failure is not an option. It's essential. Lean in. Don't disengage. Don't be cool. Stay cool. And when opportunity knocks, open the door. And those would be the sort of concluding statement. So what was she thinking? Well, that the benefits outweigh the risks. Did they not realize the consequences of what they were doing? Sure. They just have a different sense of what those are. And why didn't they just ask me first? If they did, that actually would be kind of weird. Adolescents are and should be peer-driven. The more important question is, why didn't you ask them first? How can I get into that thick skull of his? By understanding what's happening in his brain and guiding him through the normative steps of development with structure, support, and patience. These are some links. These are, of course, my mentors at UCSF, and this is me at age 15. In middle adolescence. No, I was definitely later adolescent when I was 15. No risk-taking favor happening at the pep club, I can tell you that much. Okay, so now we can have a nice discussion and people can ask some questions. What questions do we have? Yes?
I'm wondering what we should say to you know, if someone's driving fast and everyone lives, it's kind of all fine. But mm-hmm. the sort of thing of them kind of messing up the development of the brain, mm-hmm. that's so concerning that you
right.
want to say whatever you have to say to make sure that they don't really try too much until they're in their mid-20s. So what's the key message?
Well, I think the first thing is understand where your child is in their development and what kind of message they can hear. So an early adolescent, I would assert the message should be you're not allowed to do it, basically. I mean, they're too young. I think if you have a mature child that's older, it's a family decision. But I think the message is be safe. And this is how I'm safe. You know, not me personally, but this is me personifying you. I don't drive when I've been drinking. I don't get in a car with anyone who's been drinking. I don't take a drink that's been mixed and prepared for me. As a woman out in the world, I don't have more than one drink because that's unsafe and that's how violent things can happen to you. So again, having conversations like that where it's, let me tell you how to do this and do it in a safe way. Now, if your family value is no drinking by any means, ifs, ands, or buts, then that's your value. And you have to be real and talk with them about that. That, you know, your opinion is it's not a good idea until college or whenever. And you just have to give them your thought and reasons behind and then hear their thoughts and reasons behind it. I've seen a full range. Some parents say it's fine with me as long as you do it in our house. I don't really imagine myself being okay with that, especially given the upbringing that I've had. But I think expecting a kid to get through high school and not have one drink is probably unrealistic, especially when you look at the data. Yeah, you have to have a pretty extensive use. Okay. Absolutely,
so
yeah.
It's not like if your kid experiments, they're going to interrupt brain development.
Absolutely not. No, this would be with daily chronic okay. use. Again, the research is still happening, but yeah, it would be more of a sort of chronic problem. Other questions? Yeah.
I went to a youth drugs and alcohol 2-day seminar put on by the medical wives in San Francisco mm-hmm. with my kids who are now 46 and 45. So that was really empowering for mm-hmm. me to be able to talk about scientific facts.
Yeah, and I think what's even better is having the context to start the conversation. So what I really love about that example is you're saying, hey, I had this experience. I went to this lecture and I got this information and I'd like to discuss it with you versus saying, I'm pretty sure you're doing this and it's bad for your health and that kind of thing. I think it's the events like that are really nice. And I think the doctor's visit is the same, is just saying, well, we're here and this is something we're talking about today. Let's talk about it together as a family. And so I love events like that because of that. Other questions? Oh, both at the same time. We'll go with you and then, yeah.
You mentioned that late bloomers and early developers were more susceptible to bullying. Do you consider bullying a normal part of the continuum of teen development?
That's a really, really interesting and tough question. I think that there's a normal amount of teasing and sort of peer comparison that's developmentally appropriate, but I think there's a point where it crosses the line into being abusive and mean. And so I think teens naturally in early adolescence compare themselves to each other and look at differences as part of developing their own individuation. But I think there is a point when it becomes mean and hurtful, and the question is, if the person receiving the comparison is internalizing it and holding on to it, then it's likely getting into bullying. That's kind of how I would describe it. But the comparison of, you know, oh, she's got, you know, I don't know. I tend to be off the cuff. She's got like a big butt and I've got big boobs. Like, look at that. I mean, that's sort of, that could be received as mean, but a lot of that is just sort of looking at your own body and looking at how you compare to other people. But when your comments are held onto, but in sort of internalized, that's, I think, when it kind of descends into bullying. Yes.
Teenage years can be extremely creative. And the risk that we take when we express our creativity especially among peer groups. Those risks are real. Mm-hmm. They're entirely different than the risk you're discussing. Failure is not a good option going through the expression of those creative risks. It takes a risk to have a party.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a risk to try to have a girlfriend, a relationship. These are all exemplary human conduct that I think it's good to distinguish between the risks where we're doing something that's hazardous.
No, I agree. And I think that was the subtext. Obviously, I'm a physician, so I get more medicalized in my sort of review of this. But I think that's the subtext of what I was trying to say. And you, I think, have aptly kind of summarized, which is that there's normal and healthy risks. And then there's risks when you're descending into unhealthy. And I would agree with that. There's a huge risk involved in asking somebody out and being rejected and sort of dealing with that. Absolutely. Other questions or comments? Yes.
So you mentioned that in the early adolescence time that they're really vulnerable to traumatic injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Can they get over that?
Well, what I was getting at with that was more from a health perspective, like Mr. Go Down Oak Street and Hit His Head Without a Helmet kind of thing, is that it's a particularly vulnerable time for that. The other thing that I was getting at with that is metabolically, using obesity as an example, we think that having what we tend to call a toxic diet, I was trained by, for those of you who've heard Rob Lustig speak, I was trained in sort of his language. So he talks about toxic eating. And so I think that toxic eating potentially could have permanent impact on metabolism. And so I think that there's both injury that is unexpected and accidental, and then there's injury that's self-inflicted, like smoking weed every single day for your childhood or smoking cigarettes. That's kind of what I was getting at.
Well, I'm wondering if in those cases, like I'm thinking of somebody in particular who did have psychological trauma in her early adolescence and did have physical trauma in her mm-hmm. early adolescence, and I'm wondering if that is ever correctable.
Yeah. Well, I think with every patient I see, I'm always optimistic. I have a lot of patients that are not a lot, but I've had many patients over the years who were victims of sexual abuse, and I don't know if people really ever completely get over that, and I think it always sort of alters their approach and thinking. I don't think that we understand what's happening at a biological level, but I can tell you just on an anecdotal level, it's people that have been through significant trauma, whether it's loss of a parent or a sibling, it's very difficult to get it over it. And it comes out in very different ways for each individual. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. I will stay after. We're going to turn off, I think, the video. And one more question. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So how do we get access to these?
So you can just Google UCSF Mini Medical School, or I Googled the kids are all right because I was curious to see what would come up, UCSF, and this came up, so it was exciting. Josephine, Dr. Lau's slides are up from last week already with her bio, so I'm looking at the boss, that will happen with me as well. My guess is they're going to come after and ask me for these, which are currently on my laptop, because I finished them this afternoon, which is just how I roll. Okay, well, thank you, everyone. We'll rock out with a little bit of Nirvana, which is from the 90s when I was a teen. Yeah, and I will stay after with questions.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.